I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story, Newsroom Edition, where Guardian Australia's editors discuss the news of the week. In October last year, Christine Holgate, then the CEO of Australia Post, left her role after a public furore surrounding the gifting of watches to four executives as a reward for completing a big deal.
And what were the watches?
They were a Cartier watch of about value of $3,000 each.
This week, she appeared before a Senate inquiry looking into the circumstances around her departure and made some serious allegations about her treatment.
I lost my job, a job that I loved, because I was humiliated by our Prime Minister for committing no offence and then bullied by my chairman. This made my leadership at Australia Post untenable and seriously threatened my health.
She said she was cooperating with the inquiry to set the record straight.
I have committed to be part of this process. I do not want what happened to me to happen to any individual ever again in any workplace.
Today, I'm talking to Editor-in-Chief Lenore Taylor and Head of News Mike Tischer about what the handling of the Christine Holgate affair tells us about Scott Morrison's leadership. It's Friday, the 16th of April. So Christine Holgate has been in the news quite a lot this week. But before we get to why, should we go back to September, October last year and try to recall what was happening at the time?
Yeah, I think that's a really relevant thing to do because I think the key to understanding this story is to understand how it's just getting swept up in the narrative, the news narrative of the time when it surfaces. And when it surfaced last October, the dominant narrative was all about waste and waste of public money. We just found out that the government had paid 10 times more than it needed to for the land out at the Leppington Triangle near Western Sydney Airport, that they'd forked out a massive amount of money for tax advice for the head of ASIC. They were still getting over the sports fraud scandal. So I guess what would have been in the forefront of the government's mind and the Prime Minister's mind when it came out in that committee hearing that she had authorised the purchase of the famous Cartier watches was, oh my God, this is going to just play into that narrative. And, you know, and as she said subsequently, Cartier watches sort of don't pass the pub test.
Yeah. And it was kind of the midst of the COVID crisis too, wasn't it, Mike? And the unions were also a bit angry at Australia Post at the time.
Yeah, well, very specifically to do with Australia Post, there'd been a row about a month earlier about whether Australia Post executives should get their very large bonuses for the year. At the same time, they were asking their workers to volunteer to help deliver all the parcels that people had ordered, particularly during the Victorian lockdown.
Even though the watches were 2 years before that,
yeah.
But that
so
kind of got lost in
not
the rush
related,
a bit.
But one of the many confusions about timings in this story. But that was the atmosphere in which this first came to public attention, where Australia Post had looked quite bad for very justifiable reasons not long before, because they were trying to make their workers do more to deliver parcels on a voluntary basis, while simultaneously their extremely well-paid executives were sort of humming and hawing about whether they deserve their bonuses that year.
And so that, you know, created this atmosphere. But Scott Morrison was very angry about it, wasn't he?
Yeah. I mean, it went from 1 to 11 in Spinal Tap terms, like in a nanosecond. And we got sort of detailed and sort of conflicting accounts of what happened on that day when she gave evidence at the committee hearing this week. But it was very clear that the government was furious. They were determined that she should stand aside while there was an inquiry, that they were making that really clear to the board, which happened to be sort of jam full of former Liberal MPs and former Liberal senators and former Liberal advisers. I mean, it's meant to be an independent board, but clearly they're under enormous pressure. And the Prime Minister really went for Christine Holgate in question time. And I think I can understand why, for someone who had had a long career in the private sector, someone who, you know, in her world, gifts like this as a bonus were not abnormal. She says they were within her spending limits as the chief executive of Australia Post, and some of the details are disputed, but you can actually understand that for her, she started the morning fine, CEO, illustrious career, and by lunchtime, she was being excoriated by the prime minister, that would have been an incredibly shocking thing to happen to her. And I guess the lesson, I think, is that the prime minister was kind of reacting to the pub test and not to his legal requirements or to requirements of natural justice. I mean, it was clear that he hadn't been fully briefed when he went off in question time. He couldn't possibly have gotten all the information about the payments and about the requirements for a government to direct the board of a government business enterprise, which is supposed to be independent, because you're supposed to do that in writing. And there are very clear guidelines for how a government is supposed to direct a board. And, you know, it really sounded like a direction when he stands up in Parliament and says,
she's been instructed to stand aside. And if she doesn't wish to do that, Mr. Speaker, she can go.
The Prime Minister saying that, it puts the board in a really difficult position if they're going to try and maintain their independence and their job, which is to do what's best for Australia Post. And I think it's that reaction to the narrative of the day rather than calmly looking at the legal and policy requirements of the situation that's got him into so much trouble.
And also without regard to the effect on the individual person, which, as we've found out this week, was terrible. She was, you know, depressed and anxious and on having to take medication and not sleeping and potentially even suicidal after all this happened. He didn't establish the facts before he unleashed on her in a very personal way.
And looking back at it now with this different perspective, you know, we're after months of talking about how the government has a real problem dealing with women's issues. And it just is so stark, isn't it, watching him stand up and bluster, if she won't stand aside, she must go, compared to his somewhat muted response to other scandals that have happened. Is that what's happening now?
Well, I think it's now got caught up in the next narrative.
Yeah.
And again, possibly unfairly a little bit, in that I'm not really sure that his reaction was dictated by her gender. I think he was just furious at the public perception of Cartier watches. You know, let's face it, Cartier watches, it's like one of those things that, as a person who, you know, whose career went through marketing, he knows that's going to capture the public imagination, and he really reacted to that. But now the narrative is all about the government not understanding, you know, the impact of how things work for women. It's now got sort of caught up into this new narrative, and I don't know that that's entirely fair either, but it makes it very difficult for the Prime Minister. I mean, particularly because Christine Holgate has said she's considering legal action, which means that any apology by the Prime Minister could be seen as some sort of admission, could play into that legal action. So he's hamstrung in terms of what he can say and what he can do, but it's now being viewed through the prism of him, you know, not knowing how to deal with women and her allegation that it was gender-based bullying.
Whether or not he saw it, he consciously or subconsciously reacted in that way because she was a woman, she certainly interpreted it in that way, didn't she?
And, I mean, the other difficulty is, as you mentioned, Lenore, the ASIC chairman and deputy chairman were also under pressure at the time for quite outrageous expenses scandals, including, you know, $118,000 in tax advice. And where was that anger in the parliament? I mean, it makes it difficult for him under those circumstances, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think when something is being judged by the pub test, the normal sort of rational considerations of exactly where it fits into the list of wastage of money or, you know, public policy outrage sort of goes by the by, right? I mean, in any of those terms, I mean, there was a review undertaken by Maddox after the event, and it found that she hadn't done anything wrong, really, that maybe she could have paid more attention to the perception of how she was using money, but that there was no wrongdoing or illegality. But nobody paused to think about that at the time.
I mean, it sort of falls into this slightly Alice in Wonderland world of executive bonuses, doesn't it, where what is seen as completely normal and acceptable by people in the corporate world generally appears sort of grotesque to people who work normal salary jobs, I think. I mean, objectively, giving people $5,000 watches does seem kind of obscene for doing what is basically their job, however well they did it. I mean, even the fact that $5,000 watches exist might seem pretty
Wasn't
pretty
she
weird
wearing
to some
a
people.
Bulgari watch that's worth like way more than that? This is not my usual.
But however, compared with bonuses, that the amount of money that people receive, corporate executives receive in bonuses every day, it's not that exceptional.
And
not
she was
exceptional
paid
at all.
way less than her predecessor, Ahmed Fahour, like miles less.
And he spent way more on expenses too.
But nevertheless, still $2.5 million. It's two worlds colliding where people come into it with entirely different expectations of what is reasonable and what isn't.
As you mentioned, at the time they were asking staff to work overtime to deliver parcels for time in lieu, not for overtime pay, and they do that every Christmas. So I think, you know,
that was only on weekends. They got time in lieu if they did it on weekends. If they did it during the week, it was just voluntary.
But that's the unfairness of the remuneration system that, you know, happens every day and all the time.
So what does Morrison's reaction with that little information tell us about his style of leadership?
Oh, I think there is a tendency by this government to deal with every day as, you know, a news cycle and to deal with the narrative or how things look more than the substance. And it's getting them into trouble again and again and again. It's got them into trouble with the vaccine rollout because we were told we had innumerable photo opportunities of people getting injections and it all starting how it was great. We're going to be at the front of the queue and then the queue sort of got delayed. Now we don't even know where the queue is or when it's going to start, or the preoccupation with the nightly news and the spin kind of got way ahead of the substance of this incredibly important public policy. Or climate change is another story in the news this week where the government's clearly trying to establish the sort of the rhetoric, the idea that everything's getting better internationally and Australia's being seen to be more in sync with the world on greenhouse gas emission reductions because Joe Biden's in the White House and he's having a summit next week on climate change. But as of yet, there's no substantive change to policy. It's this kind of tendency of always putting the spin or the public perception ahead of the substance, which seems to trip them up lots of times.
And Morrison has often been described as a masterful distractor. And as you mentioned, first up, Lenore, sports rules was happening at the time. Leppington, did it take the public's mind off those scandals for a brief period of time?
Well, it did. It certainly did in the media. You know, the media attention was all on what happened in Parliament that day, naturally, because it was dramatic. The head of an important semi-public body might have to resign, et cetera, et cetera. It's, you know, it was completely understandable that people would report that as the main news story of the day. But it's up to the media to not lose the focus on those other underlying things in subsequent days, isn't it? Which,
yeah,
you know, hopefully,
I think you're
hopefully
right,
we didn't, but it is easy to do so, in that, and that's partly the point of what he's trying to do in that instance, for sure.
So is the lesson then that we have to, I mean, as a media organisation, how do we juggle that, Lenore? How do we juggle, like, this is obviously an interesting story that's happened today and now we're on war footing with the vaccine. How do we balance this?
I think we've always got to remember to go for the facts and sort of stick with the substance and stick with the story when the caravan moves on, which is hard to do. You know, there's limited resources, there's so many stories. But think about, you know, that thing that was the scandal and seemed the biggest story in the world 3 weeks ago. What's happened to that now? Because, you know, if you think about this, it was the biggest story back in October and it's the biggest story again now. But really what the Prime Minister and the board of Australia Post should have been thinking about was, you know, this is a very important government business enterprise. It's very important to Australians. The services are important to Australians. Did what they do, was it in the best interests of Australia Post? I would argue it definitely wasn't. There's all these small post offices now who have been campaigning in favour of Christine Holgate, taking up her cause that, you know, she's been unfairly dealt with. They've got posters in their post offices. They're rallying to her cause. It's caused enormous dissent in Australia Post. It has caused questions to be asked about the independence of the board and how well the board is fulfilling its duties. It's been really destructive to this business, which at the end of the day is what we probably should all be most concerned about.
And it's becoming, from not only her testimony but what she submitted to the inquiry as well, a lot clearer that she was quite against this privatisation push that she felt was happening to Australia Post. Does that change the story, Mike?
I mean, so the what we're talking about is the Boston Consulting Group report that we have not seen the entire report of yet, although it seems to have hinted at the possibility of privatising part of Australia Post, but not privatising it entirely. She has expressed her opposition to privatisation generally, and that does paint her for probably The Guardian in a more positive light, as does her, you know, the original deal that was the trigger for all the Cartier Watches affair in maintaining bank services and post offices, in licensed post offices throughout the country, which, as Lenore said, was extremely popular among the franchisees, but also no doubt among the people who in those smaller towns and regional areas where they need those services.
They wouldn't have a bank otherwise.
Yeah. I think in a way it's probably made it harder for the government to push through with any of those recommendations from BCG that they might have wanted to do and hive off parts of the business or privatise it to some extent, because it would look like this kind of more like a vindictive response to what's happened with Christine Holgate rather than just a sort of stand back logical decision about what's best for Australia Post. Mm.
And I think there's lessons in it for the opposition as well, because it was the opposition question. I mean, the opposition was really going for her in that original committee hearing. Mm. They'd obviously been tipped off about the watches. The Labor Senator, Kimberly Kitching, was asking very, very difficult questions. You know, Christine Holgate had a torrid time in the committee that day. And then the opposition was, you know, was calling for her resignation and saying, you know, really making political mileage with it. And then this week, suddenly, you know, they were wearing suffragette white and backing her in. I mean, I think, you know, the lessons that we're talking about that the Prime Minister could learn, the opposition could learn as well, in terms of thinking through the substance of something instead of just going for the jugular when they can see that they've got, you know, something that could be potentially politically damaging.
Mm. And I think that a lot of women I've spoken to this week, and just for me also on a personal level, there is something quite satisfying about seeing a woman get up and defend herself after being treated so poorly. And that's part of what you said before, Lenore, about we're now seeing the whole issue through a different news lens.
Yeah. Mm.
And it was interesting how she was in a position where she, perhaps unlike some of the other people who've been in the news recently, such as Brittany Higgins and so on, she was in a much stronger position to be able to do that to some extent because she had a platform that was provided for her. She was called to answer questions. She was in right across all the detail about everything that happened in the whole affair. She was extremely pointed in her criticisms, and she's got nothing to lose because, well, she does have something to lose because she's lost her job and that might affect her career, but financially she's, you know, not in a difficult position, and she's nearer the end of her career. She's, you know, nearer the end of her career than a younger woman like Brittany Higgins is, and to some extent, she has less to risk by taking a strong stand, and she did it incredibly impressively, I thought.
Next, the longest long rabbit, and why rice is useless. Okay, so I hope you have both prepared your stories that you can't get out of your head.
We didn't have to prepare because they're in our head.
Right. You're silly me. Lenore, what was yours?
Well, I'm outraged about a story that we published from The Conversation, which revealed to me that if your smartphone gets wet, you should not put it in a container of rice. I mean, could someone not have possibly told me that a little sooner?
10 years ago?
Like before I tried to restore various iPhones that my children wet by putting them in rice. Anyway, apparently you turn it off, you shake it gently, and then you dry it out in front of a fan. So now you know.
Oh, really? You dry it out in front of a fan?
According to The Conversation.
Oh, excellent news. Thank you, Lenore. Mike, can you top that?
Well, mine's slightly different. Sort of feel like I might be getting the reputation as the quirky animal guy.
Yeah.
But mine is about the continental rabbit called a Darius. I'm not sure how they pronounce it, in the UK. Continental rabbits are the largest breed of rabbits in the world, and Darius holds the record, is officially recognised by the Guinness World Records as the longest, the longest living rabbit, but that means literally the longest rabbit that's alive.
In centimetres. Yes.
He's 129 centimetres long, which is huge if you see him being held up by his owner.
Like, it sort of looks like about the size of a Labrador.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's extremely
large. But short of dog.
I hope this story isn't going to end badly, because Darius was stolen this week from his enclosure in the English county of Worcestershire, and that was a few days ago, and no word has been heard of him.
Can it be quite difficult to hide a rabbit the size of a medium-sized dog?
I mean, they went to a lot of effort to scout the property beforehand. It's in a very rural area, and it seems to have been a planned operation. And
why would someone want to steal the world's longest living rabbit?
They fear there may be a ransom involved, although I don't think we've had any word on whether that's.
I thought they might want to breed other very large rabbits.
No, he's too old to breed.
He's
surprisingly old. They knew.
So it's like a grandpa rabbit.
Yeah.
He may also be the longest living rabbit.
Longest rabbit. Yeah, he's at least 11.
Your story wins, Mike.
He won that award recognised as that in 2010, so he's at least 11, and they usually only live to 4 or 5.
Well, we hope to bring you an update on this breaking story next week.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us.
At least go look at the pictures of Darius, because he is impressive.
Thanks, Gabs.
For joining us.
Thanks.
In evidence given to the same Senate inquiry, the Australia Post chairman denied that Christine Holgate had been hounded out of her job or that the board had taken instructions from the government to remove her. That's it for today. If you liked this episode, don't forget to hit follow right now, wherever you're listening to this podcast. This episode was produced by Ryan Pemberton. The executive producers are Miles Martignoni and me, Gabrielle Jackson. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend, and Laura Murphy-Oates will be back with you on Monday.